Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour for June 29th, 2017. Wow, June is already gone. Heading into July, and I'll have a few comments on that when you head out to the holidays. The main science topic tonight, I will be talking about something that very much interests me. It is the science of life, or what we know or think we know about the scientific attributes of chemistry, physics, of life, and what we don't know. First of all, the paid cast for this week is Back to the Cosmos, The Real Story, the ongoing series. There will be a couple more episodes in July, and then that will be capped off. And so tell your friends and neighbors, if they have not signed up for the paid cast, they can still get this included in all of the episodes going back to August. But here's what I'm going to do. I'm starting to complete these series. For example, Cosmos is probably about 17 episodes. I'll be breaking that out and selling it as a separate product. So you're getting that included in your $3.95 per month paid cast. I also have Tesla's Mind, which is an ongoing series. I have The World Before the Great Flood, other series. And so eventually those will be broken out into an individual product item, you might call it, downloadable. And so people in the future, when they come in to buy the paid cast, and I'm doing this because you have to understand, if people come in and buy now, they have to buy the paid cast all the way back to August if they want the full show. And so anyway, it'll be easier for them if they see an individual package that they want to listen to, like Cosmos or Tesla's Mind or The World Before the Great Flood, and they can pick those up at a price in addition to just signing up for the $3.95 a month paid cast. That's the madness to that logic there. First of all, Joyce Riley has passed away this past week. I'm sure most of you probably already know this. I've been on her show for, I don't know, many years as a guest. I know I was one of her favorite guests. And now Daniel is taking over the show, The Power Hour. Joyce started that show in the year 2000. And relatively only recently was I a guest there. But Joyce, when you look at the expressions she used about finding truth and understanding the truth and bringing the truth to you, and she was always very happy because I know that when I was on that show, a lot of people came in and listened. Their numbers certainly were higher. That happens on a lot of shows where I'm guest. But Joyce Riley, it was a shock to me because I knew she had been missing shows for about a month and a half. The last time she actually was on a show with me was a number of months ago. Daniel was taking over the show and interviewing me. But I didn't know that she was in critical condition like that. I thought maybe someday she would come back. So when I got the email saying that she had passed away, it was very much a shock to me. But I also want to say something a bit more on a, say, spiritual level. I have been, and this is going to come out somewhat in my work, it's already coming out in my paid casts, where I talk about science being atheistic. Now, Joyce was a nurse. She was in Desert Storm. She was one of the first to speak up publicly in the military. She was a military nurse to expose what was going on with our military personnel coming back from the front and with the what turned out to be radiation poisoning from depleted uranium and other chemicals being sprayed in the field. And Gulf War syndrome. She was one of the first ones to start exposing that. But Joyce was a trooper, let's just put it that way, in the military. And then when she was a civilian, I understand from her webpage that I didn't know this, but she was a quilter, a master quilter, which meant that she sewed quilts. And of course, that's a whole amazing branch of artwork in itself. But I mentioned this when I wrote back to the studio. I was in shock when I got the email. I said, I'm going to go take a walk outside and I'm going to say hello to Joyce on the astral plane. And I was serious about that. Now, we live in this three-dimensional world with our senses, with our all of our wants and needs, with our body, with our, you know, all of the things that we do. But I have in my career and in my study and just examination of the world and the universe come to understand that there's more than just these bodies walking around on this planet Earth. When we look at dogs and animals and monkeys and cats and snakes in the ground or insects, they, in fact, I'll be talking about this tonight. My definition of life is any cellular, chemical, biological process that does not obey the second law of thermodynamics. In other words, a fire burning is something that proceeds by certain laws. It's inanimate. It's not going to change. A fire in the wood doesn't have the ability to stand up and say, I'm not burning anymore. I'm going to move over here, or I'm going to move this log out of the fire and it's not going to burn with the rest of the fire. No, it follows the whatever factors are there. If it rains, it could put the fire out. But all of these factors follow the rules of nature. Living things do not, because they store up energy and they can react. But then you get up to humans, and we do things like look up at the stars. We have radio shows. We have feelings. We have compassion towards other people. Some of us do. Some people, if they're people even, like the Bushes, have no compassion for anything or anybody. But my point is that there is ample evidence that when people die, their soul leaves the body, because the body is mortal. It's then goes back. And at that point, literally, it becomes obedient to the second law of thermodynamics. Prior to that, that same body there was not subject to the second law of thermodynamics. In other words, it did not follow a set guided path of chemical and physical processes. It had the ability to change and do things and write and learn and remember and have relationships with other people. And this is more than a simple body can do. I don't care how big your brain is or how it has developed from lizards or whatever else. There is a spirit in that body, and that spirit is connected in, and there's more than ample evidence for this. We do not, as scientists, put meters on this and measure it, and that's why science totally ignores this. That's why most scientists are atheists, because they can't put a meter on everything like this and measure it, so they just say, well, it can't exist then. But so when I said to the, wrote back to the studio, the GN, it's GCN, Genesis Communication Network, GCN, I said, I'm going to walk outside and take a walk outside and say hello to Joyce on the astral plane. And that's what I did. Now, I couldn't hear her talking back to me, because we still live in this like three-dimensional world we live in, contained in this body. But I know she could sense me. And so there's ample evidence of this. In fact, I'll be talking more about that in my show tonight. But it is difficult for us on this planet, the people that are left here, and I have seen so many good people in my career, going back decades and decades and decades. I've seen so many good people come and go, so many talk show hosts, and I thank God that I'm still here. I'm still doing my work. I still have a lot of work to do. But the loss of these people, other people like, I'm not going to name other people, but just the whole host of people who have gone before and are no longer with us, who've done wonderful work. But also I see that we're still fighting the same fight. 20 years ago, or when Joyce was in the military, in the in the early 1990s, what were we dealing with? George Bush Sr., and the war mongers. Those people are still running or trying to run the show through their kids or through their associates, etc. Good grief. Isn't it time we just stood up and said, no more, no more, no more, so that the lives and the efforts of people like Joyce Riley come to fruition, that our kids can walk down the street without thinking that they're going to be tossed off in some war that's made by psychopaths that have no concern or compassion for anybody, and their only motivation is greed and power. On to the next topic. But Joyce will be sorely missed. I can say that she was a friend of mine, although I never met her personally in the same room, but certainly we met on the radio and off radio. A lot of times we would talk or communicate before shows. So Joyce will be surely missed. And it just makes it a bit heavier on the rest of us when somebody that important leaves. But I guess I'm lost for words now. So on to the next topic. I'm fighting a bit of a congestion, so if my voice sounds a little weak, that's because it is. So hopefully we'll get through this show. Okay, this past week, a tornado on the sun actually was reported by CNN, so this was considered major news. It was a film by NASA, and it ran for 40 minutes. The video didn't show 40 minutes, but the tornado looked just like a tornado or a dust devil on Earth, running across the surface of the sun. And in the mid-1990s, when I worked with high-level Russian scientists at the University of Novosibirsk in Russia, central Russia, they were atmospheric scientists, and they became interested in my work, translated it, had daily meetings on teaching it and asking me questions, etc., to clarify the work, because one of the things they had seen and already observed were the tornadoes on the sun. They thought, what the heck is going on here? And these are big, big structures. So it turned out that they were also studying atmospheric phenomena on Earth, tornadoes, etc., and cyclonic storms and hurricanes and other electrical atmospheric phenomena. So they were very interested in my work to explain what was causing these. And literally, a tornado on the sun is an electrical discharge. It's a connection on the sun, on the surface of the sun. And it's basically the same force that causes when you fill up your bathtub with water and you pull a plug and there's the little vortex that forms there. It's the same process, but what happens on the sun is it's an electrical discharge, and the positive ions, which are down closer to the surface of the sun, and then there's the negatively charged corona, which is the sea of relativistic electrons, which orbits the sun. It's basically a superatom. Once these discharge gets going, it's just like a tornado on Earth, which is driven by the electrical conditions from the ionosphere. So it's the very same process. And so we had this nailed down in the mid-1990s, but very interesting, if you go to CNN, the Clinton Network News, as many people call it. I used to call it the Candy Nugget News because they really don't have any real news there. But I'm sure you can also find this on a NASA website. Just look for it. And there's many videos of tornadoes on the sun. Next topic. In Baltimore, police were ordered to stand down during rioting, which looted and destroyed the downtown area of that city. The mayor told the police to stand down, and they did nothing. From observation, it was preventable, they said. They could have prevented all of this, but the police did nothing. And now the store owners are suing the police and the city for, you know, I don't know how this will fare out, but this idea that people just can go crazy and destroy a city is very bizarre, because these are a lot of innocent people who are not part of the bone of contention, so to speak. So, but another point here is that when people go out, we're heading into the 4th of July now, and we knew earlier in the summer before that the George Soros's of the world would be trying to cause problems at public events this summer, and especially 4th of July, which is clearly our Independence Day, and what better place to cause violence and disarray than on 4th of July. So I just want people to be aware of that. Have your, as you're enjoying celebrations, or if you're going out, or if you're in public at any place, whether you're, you know, no matter where you are, have your head up and your eyes open. Don't let your guard down. And the people who do have and are comfortable with arms carrying, really, I would suggest doing that, because as with the case in Washington, D.C., where this guy tried to assassinate Republican senators and House members, it was stopped by two police, a man and a woman, police who, from the account that I heard Trump talking about, they charged into the fire of this guy with their guns drawn shooting. I mean, this is just insane. But it turns out that if you're in public, you might be the only person that can defend yourself or other people. And so that's the way they, is this the way they want this country to be? Like a third world banana republic dictatorship or something, which leads into the next story. There was a guy named John Perkins who wrote a book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman, in which he described the CIA going into third world countries, and first they would try and negotiate with the leaders, then they would bring in the strong arms, then they would bring in social rioting, then they would bring in economic pressure from banks, then there would be boycotts. And if all of this didn't work, then the CIA moved in with infiltrating public gatherings and shooting and blaming it on the government. And then if that didn't work, it actually got to the point, for example, during the Reagan administration, where they literally invaded a country because all of these other banana republic CIA techniques did not work. They are now doing this in Venezuela. They've gone through all of the initial phases of attempting economic coups and economic sanctions, and then reporting in the Western press that they don't know how to run their country. Well, let me tell you something. If you are in a little country and were oil rich, but had a problem selling on the world market because you had sold out of the petrol dollar, that was your crime to humanity. and they're trying to cause regime change. I mean, they talk about Russia interfering in our election, which there's no proof of. Nobody's ever presented a dime of proof, but we have vast amounts of proof that the CIA is involved in these countries trying to overturn. And you may not like it, you may like it, you may not like it, but the president in Venezuela was elected by the people. And so, you know, that the CIA is in there because they're not playing ball with the bankers. The CIA is the police force of the World Bank. It's as simple as that. But basically, what you hear in the Western news about Venezuela or Ecuador or Bolivia and many of the other countries, they were able to get Brazil back during the Olympic Games. They had a coup that occurred during the Olympic Games, overthrowing the elected president of Brazil, getting Brazil ousting them from the association with Russia and China and the other countries that were in that international economic alliance. There was a global cyber attack this past week. I personally really didn't have the ability nor the time to look into details as to what was going on. But I wrote a number of books on this topic. One of them is called Calculate Primes, where I showed the solution broke the basically what are known as RSA encryption codes or public key encryption codes, or there's other terms for it. But basically, then I wrote a book in 2014, published it, called Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit. But the cyber world that is controlled by the NSA and the CIA has not allowed the world, the cyber world, to adopt new secure computing algorithms that are for transmission or for firewalls. So basically, governments, corporations in the world, etc., are using broken encryption systems. And then they caught the NSA selling under the table for money to the NSA, selling the access codes for their encryption programs that they were selling to businesses. I also report about that in my book, Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit. But this cyber attack going on, you know, who knows who's behind this? Hard to even speculate. There's probably coming from China, there's probably coming from the U.S., from the NSA. The NSA has been caught multiple times with their malware that they developed in the hands of hackers. And, you know, so it's just a free-for-all out there. This could have been prevented. It could be solved, but it takes someone like myself that understands this world and knows it could lead an effort to actually stop it. But as long as the NSA and CIA demand that they have access to everybody's computers, this will never stop. The next topic, Yellowstone, continues to have eruptions. And I've talked about draining the lake at Yellowstone, the three supervolcano events in history with pyroclastic explosions. Those are the massive steam explosions that would blow that a massive amount of earth over probably a 20-state area, devastate the United States. The three cases of supervolcanoes at Yellowstone throughout history, going back millions of years, was when there was a lake present. And so what happens is that water falls down into, once the earthquake started and the rumbling starts, the water breaks through fissures going down to the magma, and once it starts exploding, then there's a reverberation process in which more water drops down, changes to super steam, and eventually, if that lake turned to steam, I mean, it would just be the end of the United States. So we have to drain the lake at Yellowstone National Park. I show how to do it on my webpage in the southeast sector of the lake. There's a bridge there's a actual channel that goes to a region, and all we'd have to do is cut that channel out and make a path for the water to pass, and it would go down through basically the scab lands of Oregon, which is basically unused terrain all the way, and that would settle in there and filter out and eventually evaporate and become part of the water system again. But if we don't drain that lake, we're headed for a super volcano. And what it may do is it may relieve pressure on the dome, on the lava dome that's under Yellowstone. So we'd have to drain that lake relatively quickly. But then all we'd be looking at is a major lava flow, not a pyroclastic explosion. Next topic. That was reported that Zhang, she was a Chinese student. I don't know if they found her yet at the time of this airing of this show, but she was going to one of the Illinois State Universities, disappeared one of two, they say 329,000 university students in the USA from China. These are Chinese students that have gotten into the universities. And a lot of them, I don't know what the percentage, but a lot of them are in graduate school. And so, and that was the case with this young woman. I certainly hope they find her and that she's okay. I don't know what the results are. But this number of students in universities in the United States has tripled in the last 8 years, from about 100,000 to over 300,000 now. But understand that this is 300,000 student positions in our own universities that are not available for local United States students. And I always objected to this when I was, say I was at Cornell or I was at other university settings, where they would have these graduate students as sit-ins for either problem sessions or actually some of them sitting in for professors in a classroom, and they couldn't even speak English. And so these students are, undergraduate students are paying huge amounts of money, and they have somebody teaching the class that doesn't even speak English. But the other point is that it always amazed me that American students could not get into American university, and that's my point here. 300,000 plus Chinese students, and then that's just China. That doesn't count all of the other countries in the world. You know, possibly as many as 500,000 students in the universities in this country for which American students cannot get seated. Okay, on to the main science topic, the science of life. And I gave an example at the beginning of this show about a fire. Let's look at just a campfire. You put the wood up, you pile it up, you get a nice, you know, you put your kindling material on the bottom, you strike a little match, it starts to burn, now you start putting bigger wood on, and you sit around the campfire and you watch it, and as the wood burns down, some of it will fall and then start to cascade in and fall on the coals and burn. Then it reacts and burns bigger, and then you put more wood on the fire. All of this is following what we call the second law of thermodynamics. The fire is doing what a fire should do. It does not have the ability to change itself. Yeah, although I should mention that, you know, the indigenous people in a lot of countries in the United States as well attributed spirits to fire, to volcanoes, to comets, to natural events, to earthquakes, to tsunamis. And, for example, Quetzalcoatl, which was the plumed serpent god of the Mayas and the Incas, by the way, had the ability to create earthquakes and mountain building and tsunamis and volcanic activity, etc. And, of course, I've explained that as being due to the cause, the action at a distance of a large comet passing by Earth. And so these were not understood by the ancients, so they attributed a godlike properties to these entities, which they did not understand. The ancients called comets the lawless ones. Well, against what law? They had established the movement of the planets in the heavens that followed regular patterns, and they could follow them, but the comets did not follow those. And in fact, you look at Halley's Comet, it could be as many as 3 to 6 years off of schedule. That's a tremendous amount of time. You certainly would not expect Venus or Mars or Jupiter to be years off schedule. I mean, Jupiter only has an orbit of 10 years. So to be off by years or months is simply unheard of. But comets do that. And why did they do that? That's because they're interacting with planets. But they also have something that I've defined called the tail drag, where the comet, the negatively charged comet that is charged, it's not simply charged out of the middle of nowhere. The charging process is integral in the discharge of the solar capacitor, but that leaves the region around the comet nucleus negatively charged, so it's drawing in positively charged ions from the distance. And that's what we see as the comet tail. But that comet tail then is being drawn into the nucleus, and likewise, due to Newton's laws, the nucleus is being pulled back towards the tail. And if there's enough tail material, then the nucleus is going to have its orbit changed. And this is what I term tail drag. Tail drag. And so, and that is the cause of so-called lawlessness of the comets. But this is explainable if you understand the true nature of comets. So comets really are not lawless. The ancients simply did not understand all the rules. Okay, so now back to the second law of thermodynamics. If you understand what the rules are, the plasma discharge comet model, and discharging the solar capacitor and electrical discharges if the comet comes by Earth, and if the earthquakes and the tsunamis and the other effects that could be caused by a comet, that the ancients attributed godlike properties or a deity, then you understand that these are really following the second law of thermodynamics, because they're following the natural processes that have been defined in the universe. So if a comet exists in a solar system on the far side of the universe, it's going to follow those same rules. It may act a little in a different way because of different conditions, but like the fire, it's going to follow the rules of the road. So as a big fire burns down, then it's going to eventually collapse and it'll burn down to coals and eventually burn itself out. It does not have the ability to change itself or its course of action, its course, its destiny, so to speak. Okay. So what is the difference between a hydrocarbon molecule in a petroleum, a vat of petroleum, and a hydrocarbon molecule in a DNA nucleotide that's being used to build up DNA in your body, which is a living entity, and does not follow the second law of thermodynamics? In other words, I've used this example before. Right now, on the count of three, I want to raise my right hand. There's no reason for me to do this. I'm not defending myself against somebody throwing something at me. I'm not reacting in some manner. I just want to raise my right hand. So I'm going to count to three, and I'm going to do that. So it's one, two, three. Oops, no. I'm going to count to four. And then I'm going to do it. So one, two, three, four. Now I raised my right hand because I did it when I wanted to. Not because I counted to three, because I decided at the last minute I didn't want to raise it. At three, I wanted to count to four. That put me in total control of raising my right hand. There's no thermodynamic reason for me to raise my right hand. There's no thermodynamic reason for me to talk on this radio show, nor for you to listen. There's no thermodynamic natural course of the evolution of the burning of the energy and the chemicals in our body, for you to come down and at a certain time listen to the show. I wish everybody in the world would listen to my show every week and it was mandatory. That'd be wonderful. But it's not the way it is. You listen because you decide that. You want to. You turn on the radio or the computer or listen to the archive, you know, the way of listening to my show, because you decide to do that. Or in the case of the trolls, because the government's paying them to do that, and they have to. So anyway, none of this follows the second law of thermodynamics. So what makes where does the difference come in when we're down at the molecular level? When does a series of carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen become a living entity? Because you can have those combined in a structure and not be a living entity. In other words, they would follow all the rules of the second law of thermodynamics. They would not decide that they're going to do something different. Where's that line? And I guarantee you that if you go to any chemistry class or professor or theorist or physical chemist or physicist or biologist or evolutionary biologist, if you go to anybody on this planet and you ask them that question, not a single person can give you an answer. Not a single person can give you the answer as to why the same set of molecules, the four basic building blocks of life, and then there's you throw in phosphorus and other sodium and other, you know, elements, and you get biological life, and it does not obey the second law of thermodynamics. It changes. What on earth or in the universe causes this? Nobody can tell you. Where's the magic? Where is the element here that we can put a meter on and say, wow, well, when these carbon, oxygen, nitrogen atoms do this, now all of a sudden they don't obey the second law of thermodynamics anymore. They're living, as opposed to the same four molecules over here, atomic structure. Or we take something even as complicated as our body. When we die, our body lays there immobile, not able to digest, not able to function anymore because one or more of the parts are not functioning. But they're all the same molecules that were there an hour ago. What's the difference? What is the difference? They're all the same, but we don't really ask these serious questions in terms of higher order. And that's what we're talking about here. These are things that we as mortal humans cannot grasp or understand. What makes organic molecules different from inorganic molecules? There's two big major divisions in chemistry. You can become an organic chemist or an inorganic chemist. The inorganic is very well known that these are not structured towards systems that are living. And so you have all of the physics and the chemistry and the physical chemistry of inert objects, what we call inert. In other words, non-animated. They're not mobile, and if they move, there's some known physical process that's causing them to move, and they respond in a manner that's consistent with the second law of thermodynamics. In other words, what the second law of thermodynamics says, that if you have a system that's organized, it tends to move in a direction of less organization. In other words, it dissipates. It doesn't become more organized by itself. And we have all kinds of systems that do become more organized, for example, a star. But they are following the second law of thermodynamics in the stellar formation. And they don't have the ability to decide one day, I'm just not going to become a star today. I'm just not going to do it. I put the limit down. I'm not going to become a star today. No, they don't have that ability. They're not alive. They don't have self-directing motivation or thoughts, etc., even though the indigenous also put a spirit in the earth called Gia, the earth spirit. And we talk about vibrational patterns in the earth and resonant modes and frequencies, which Tesla discovered, and all types of resonant conditions with the atmosphere interacting with the earth, etc., and the ionosphere. All of these conditions we can put a meter on and measure, etc., but they are all responding to physical the physical laws. And but I should say there are people who believe that there is an earth spirit. In other words, the Peruvians, for example, I spent a good time in Peru. They you cannot walk down the block without somebody saying Pachamama. I mean, it is just it's probably the most used word in the Peruvian culture, going back, you know, hundreds if not thousands of years. The Pachamama is the Mother Earth, that gives us our life and everything, and we are part of the Mother Earth. And so the people believe and feel spiritually attached to Pachamama. And it makes sense, because when you start to look at life in that respect, it makes sense. I mean, it makes sense. But once again, modern science cannot put a meter on it and say, yeah, here's the life the life entity of the earth, and here's its reading today, etc. It's something that you feel. And so when we go out into, you know, so when the spirit leaves our body and the body is laying there with motionless, whereas hours earlier it was live and disobeying the second law of thermodynamics, all of a sudden it is transformed into an entity, all the same cells, all the same biological structure, not obeying before death, not obeying the second law of thermodynamics immediately after death, when the body ceases to function, it now begins to obey all of the laws of the second law of thermodynamics and all other physical laws. What's the difference? Where does this cross? And now we have people, and I just heard another accounting the other day, a very good one, of a woman living in the United States who had severe cancer, who had a near-death experience. She left her body. She went into the astral plane, was able to see all the people in the room where she was, her body was, where she was dying, and decided to go back into her body. And eventually self-cured herself, because she had severe terminal lymphatic cancer. And weeks later was able to walk out of the hospital. So, of course, that doesn't happen all the time. But the point is, we have enough recounting of these incidents to know that there is something there. We can't see it. We can't touch it. And interestingly enough, as much as I criticize a guy named Carl Sagan, he did a very, very good expose on one of his Cosmos series talking about two-dimensional people, and he spent quite a bit of time explaining this. The only problem with Carl is that he then completely washed it all under the rug and denied the spirit of the human species. But basically, he talked about an example in which he had triangles and circles and little flat pieces of paper on the table, and he called it two-dimensional world. He had a name for it, I forget. The Flatland, I think they called it. And so the people moved around only on this table. They could communicate only on their level. They did not know about up or down in what we would call the third dimension. They only communicated on their level, but we could be up here in the third dimension looking down on them as they moved around in their two dimensions. And then he went into a very good discussion of what it would be like to have a fourth dimension that is outside of our three-dimensional world. It was a great, great discussion. But then he ends it by saying basically that man is an evolved species and he's just smarter than the average ape. That human species, he just basically denied the idea that there's a spirit that lives inside of our bodies. And so at any rate, I'm just like, woo, okay, that's not the way I see things. So the question comes back to this idea of life. What defines life? Why does this group of molecules right now, why is it functioning? And I mean, there's a tremendously complex system here. You know, hundreds of enzymes and reactions and a pituitary gland and the lymphatic system and the vascular system and the heart and the lungs and the oxygen and all the exterior conditions, you know, and the protective ionosphere and the protective magnetic field and thousands of conditions in the atmosphere. There's not too much oxygen or too little. There's just the right amount for us to breathe. The plants that are here that we have to ingest to survive and live on a daily basis. You know, I mean, this is a complex set of existential rules that we live in on a daily basis. And most people are worried about the stock market. Never get to the point of thinking about how important the human species is. Not only because we're just happen to be a smarter monkey on the universe, but because of all the matter in the universe, the stars, the galaxies, the quasars, the big planets and planet Earth, of all the matter in the universe, imagine the extremely small amount of matter that goes into our bodies. Yet, what is the most important thing in the universe? What is the entity that has the ability to look up at stars and go, wow, who created those? Or look at the order, or look at spectroscopy or the physical laws and understand that that's the point of my book, The Diamond Principle, that when you find a diamond on the other side of the universe, it's going to follow the same building code, so to speak, as the diamond we find on this side of the universe. So we find a universe where it's universally the laws are similar everywhere. This is not some chance interaction of things as scientists would want you to believe. No, this is a tremendous plan. And then you get up to the point where there's organic molecules. And when those organic molecules continue to combine in the right patterns, you get all the way up to the human beings. You know, there's something that I want to say here about evolution also. There's certainly something going on that we don't know about, and evolution does not, I repeat, does not fill the bill. Nobody, and this is, I'll use Carl Sagan's own scientific criteria. In one of his, when I did my paycast a couple of weeks ago, one of the Cosmos series that Sagan did, he was talking about UFOs, and he was trying to downgrade the idea that people have had close encounters of the third kind, where they were actually abducted by UFO people. And he was trying to downgrade that. And he ended by saying there's no clinical proof that any of it ever happened. So I want to use that same clinical proof on evolution. There is no clinical proof that everything that they talk about evolution, I don't care if it's from the smallest amoeba up to the next living entity that they claim evolved, all the way up to human beings, where is the criteria, the laboratory proof, reproducible proof, that shows that we evolved from anything. It doesn't exist. It simply doesn't exist. So evolution is a non-provable theory. And if you look at it, creation is a non-provable concept also. But if you're a creationist, then you should not rely on scientific arguments to bolster your argument. You just say that's due to faith. You believe that this was created by God, and that's the end of the story. You should not, you cannot, and should not rely on some kind of logical scientific explanations to bolster your cause, because there is no proof. You'd be using the same techniques to try and prove creationism as the evolutionists, who cannot prove evolution because you can't get it in a laboratory and decide that man evolved from the ape, or that the apes were originally lizards, or that the birds evolved from dinosaurs, or whatever. Where's the laboratory proof using Sagan's own criteria? Using Sagan's own criteria, there is no proof for evolution. Very simple. And so it sounds like a good story. It's pretty convincing. I mean, when you're in third grade, it's probably pretty believable. But by the time you get to fifth or sixth or eighth grade, there should be some, you know, eyeballs rolling around in the head going, wait a minute. This is like, you know, this is not making all that much sense in all planes and avenues. At any rate, I don't want to get into evolution here tonight, other than to a little aside note, because when we're talking about biological life, that is the standard explanation, that somehow we're just a smarter than average monkey or lizard walking around on this planet, and that it all happened here on planet Earth. That's one of the other things they love to promote, that the Earth was born, was fabricated, then life appeared, and then evolution started, you know, and 4 billion years later, here we are, you know, evolution. Whoa, wait a minute, Batman and Robin, Boy Wonder Robin. You know, run that by me again. That was pretty quick. That was like what we called in college, if there was a professor that, we were pretty brutal on professors. If a professor ever walked in the room and did not know something, we were on top of it right away. And that guy knew not to show up in our classroom not knowing his stuff. We called it hand waving. It was like, okay, now here you got this, and here's the answer over here. Okay, see you later. Whoa, no, wait a minute. You know, you better walk into a classroom where I was a student. Or if I was on the other side of the desk where I walked into a classroom, I knew too that those students out there had read the lesson, some of them, most of them, and that they were going to have questions, and you better be on your toes, because you never know where, especially the smart students, they're going to challenge you. And you better be on your toes if you're up in the front of that classroom. And that's where you learn, where the students learn respect for a teacher. Because when they hit you from all four sides and et cetera, and you can, you know, talk to them and give them answers, or if you don't know and point things out like evolution, then they respect you because they want to know the truth. They're there to learn. They're not there to get fed full of a bunch of lines of BS. I guarantee you. They're paying way too much money for that. Unfortunately, that's what they get too many times. So now let's talk about something else. Let's talk about a worm. Is it possible that a worm is walking around with a spirit in it that we don't know about? We don't have any communication. We don't have any way to really understand it. Or how about other animals that we really don't have a lot of communication with? How about bats in the night, or all those creatures you hear out at night, you don't know what they are, but you hear them making doo-doo-doo-doo, you know, jungle noises in the jungle or whatever. We don't know. I mean, there could be a lot of things going on here that we're really not connected to. So we sometimes make a lot of assumptions, and we really don't have proof for them. We put ourselves at the very top of the food chain or the spiritual chain, etc. But there again, we do not have proof for that. The only proof we have is that the animals, which have been distinguished and from the very beginning writings in history, man has been able to distinguish himself from the animals because man has a spirit, that we can do things, we can decide to do things. Animals primarily react to their environment. They eat, they sleep, they run away from enemies, and then they like to hang out and relax, etc., which is pretty human also. But, you know, I'm not aware of any monkeys that sat down and have been doing quantum mechanics lately, or developing Schrodinger equations, or developing new recipes for the kitchen, or fine French pastries. No, they're happy just to eat a banana off the tree. That's what all their ancestors did. It's good enough for them, and they're not going to change a thing. So people are different. There's something very special about a creature like humans who not only can change their environment and build housing, etc., but can develop higher attributes like music, literature, art, you know, the philosophy, the understanding of man's plight, whether it's Camus or, you know, Freud or whatever it might be, but to delve into these topics that are essential for our quest for who we are and why we're here and what are we doing and where are we going, all of those questions. So it puts the human being apart. And then also the fact that if you're really tuned to it, like I believe I am, that you have a spirit. And there's a spirit living in this body, and I'm interacting with the spirit that's living in your body, and one of the mechanisms we're using is the body, the sound, the talk, the sight, the visuals, the, you know, I can make drawings, I can transmit ideas, or when I sat down to do my my prime number problem and working on that my whole life, finally solving it, 2,500-year-old mathematics problem that had stumped every mathematician and physicist for the past 2,500 years. And I can present that in a way that 95% of you out there can understand it. You know, there's something different going on here. So the point of this discussion is, what do we know about life? What do we think we know about life? And what do we not know about life? And in the category of not know, it's much greater. This is Jim McCanny. Remember that the sale on the webpage for water filters is still there. 10% plus an extra 5% off on major water filter items. The paid cast, $3.95 a month. Don't leave home without it. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. The webpage, jmccsci.com. And we are at the crossroads. Good night.